Good evening. This is module 17, Looking at Self and Selflessness, talk 9, the 51 mental factors or samskaras. I do want to thank Sandra for finding this wonderful document. You know that I'm not an enthusiast for reading lists at all, but when I saw this, I found that it was so valuable to us that it was worthwhile spending an evening on it. And we did go through the fourth skanda very quickly without taking a look at it. And in fact, it's extremely valuable. This is a way to make our path workable. We've had a lot to say about sudden awakening, that when we relax and we've given up the struggle and we're awake, then realization can happen. But it might take a long time if we don't have a way to help ourselves to get there. So there is sudden awakening, but there's also gradual work, which we can really do. And the wonderful thing about this gradual work is that it prepares us very realistically and practically for sudden awakening. So rather than just wait patiently and hope that something will happen, or rather than trying to reason our way into enlightenment, which we're also told doesn't work, we can actually work on ourselves. We can purify our mind stream and abandon confusion. We can do this as a project which, if we are willing to do the hard work, gradually over time really starts to transform us. So in terms of the airplane of sudden awakening, if our mind is a thicket of confusion, it's hard for that airplane to land. But if we can prepare that landing field, it's more likely to happen. So if you recall the fifth skanda, to go back just a moment, we talked about it two classes ago. It's a consciousness, but it's a very limited consciousness. It's what you might call a Goldilocks zone. The game is not to touch the electric fence of being awake. In other words, the purpose of this consciousness is to keep us from getting anywhere near wakefulness. And what consciousness does is to call up the previous skandhas to seduce something in, so we can just deal with it that way, to expel and get angry at something, so we can deal with it that way, or to find a way to ignore it. So it calls up the previous skandhas to do that work. And the first three go by so fast that they arrive in an instant. The fourth one is also quite fast, but it happens to be very rich in detail. So if we've done something really stupid and unaware, and we barely knew we were doing it at the time, the fourth skanda is perfectly capable of coming up with a lot of reasoning and justification for why we did it. That's its nature. And if someone convinces us, or we convince ourselves that we did something, we really didn't do something, the fourth skanda can still come up with good reasons why we did it. The fourth skanda can come up with reasons and justifications for anything in the world, any idea, however crazy, anything that needs to be explained to ourselves, to someone else. But it also works for enlightenment. That is, the fourth skanda is the apparatus of the mind that can help us to wake up and realize the factors that lead to realization, the 11 wholesome states of mind. So what I'd really like to work on in this hour, or even less maybe, that we have, is to spend as much time as we can on the 11 wholesome states of mind. Now, this is going to be very hard for us because we live in uncertain, scary times, and our mind goes out to threats and anger at something happening, and our mind wants to dwell there. So we're going to need some special effort not to go there right away, but to work on the factors that lead to enlightenment. This is a very useful, sensible, sane thing to do. Because if we can cultivate these factors of enlightenment, then when it comes to dealing with things like threats in the world and things that are really bothering us in the world, we will still be able to think of them, but we'll be able to think of them more accurately, more sensibly, and avoid just draining ourselves by chewing our cud with the same angry thoughts or avoidance thoughts or whatever it is we do. You with me? Mm-hmm. So the theme for tonight is how to cultivate wholesome states of mind. We are going to go briefly through all 51, which is why I need readers. But we're going to spend as much, plenty of time on the wholesome states, and please try to stay with that until we've done it. Then we can go on to the confused states. But let's try to stay here. The point is that long-standing habits of our mind can really be changed. We can change them if we do the work. It takes gradual hard work, and it produces very real results. This outline that we have has six parts. You'll notice that they're labeled with letters A through F, and under each one is a list of factors. So we're going to go through them in order so as not to create confusion. If we hop around, that will create a lot of confusion. So we're going to take all 51 in order, but that doesn't mean we're going to spend much time on each one of them. Some of them are worth spending more time on than others. So, who's the first reader? Please, quickly.
I'm the first reader.
Okay.
What am I reading next?
Section A, the five ever-present factors.
Not reading the whole thing, just naming them?
Naming them.
Okay. Interest, contact, feeling, attention, and discernment.
These are described as neutral. For those of you who have the text, you can see that. What neutral means is that they can be used by our mind for awakening, and they can be used by the mind for confusion. They are part of the apparatus of the mind that has to be there if we're going to hold to any object, whether it's a enlightened object or a confused object. So there are five of them, and they're put in order, which doesn't mean that you have to take the order too seriously, but they're always there. They are what enable us to hold something, hold it well, pay attention to it, be able to keep paying attention to it, and to come back to it so that we don't forget it. Does anyone want to address these? You are welcome to address them.
Michael, when I read these, I thought, well, they're just another way of stating the five skandhas. Especially they have discernment and feeling, which are two of the skandhas. But they sound so much like the...
They do. So I'm going to make some statement, which I hope you take to heart, which is there is no consistent theory. If we talk about all the different lists, there is no consistent way to put together any kind of a theory whatsoever. Each list, take it for what it is, and these, furthermore, it's biased. It's biased not to present a theory. It's biased to giving us what we need to wake up. In other words, it's saying something which hopefully we can take hold of and use for our own wakefulness. Okay?
Yeah, that's what I sort of thought. I said, you read this, and it kind of really enhances what you know about the skandhas.
It enhances. There are connections.
And connections, right.
There are all kinds of connections, but we can't. And the words sometimes have a somewhat different meaning here, too.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So we have these five, ending with something called discernment, which identifies the object, sees how it's different than other objects, and without this, the mind could not really pick up anything and look at it in detail, compare it to other things. This can be used by what we call conceptual confused mind, but it can also be used by enlightened mind. So they're neutral. Should we go on to the next list? Next reader for the five object ascertaining factors.
Aspiration, appreciation, recollection or mindfulness, absorption, understanding.
These are factors which aren't always present but are sometimes needed. And they're sometimes needed in combination, sometimes just one or two of them are needed. If you take the document and read it carefully, which we don't really have time to do, it explains how different ones are used in different ways to work on waking up our mind. But it can also be used for samsaric mind. It can be used to study very carefully how to do something which is perfectly reasonable in the world and not terribly bad, like how to play the piano, which is not the same as how to wake up. Or they could be used for how to hurt people, exploit, or how to put ourselves down and feel bad. They can be used in all different ways. They're neutral. And they come up as needed, either for confusion or for realizing our enlightened mind, or factors that lead to waking up. Does anyone want to spend more time on any of them? Okay, we are going on, and this is the heart of things here, really. We have the 11 wholesome factors, and in a minute we will read a list of them, then we'll take more time slowly going over these. These are worth going over. Before we do that, I want to read part of a comment that appears at the very end. This comment is so important. These 11 wholesome factors should not be taken for granted, as often they are quite weak in our stream of being. They are a potential of our mind stream, and it depends on us to strengthen them through the practice of Dharma. One actually has to train in them. So this is the piece of practical advice. This is the heart of why, actually, I wanted to give this talk. That we should actually look at this and see how we can train in the wholesome factors. So, reader, please read 11 wholesome factors.
All right, then. Faith, self-respect, respect for others, non-attachment, non-hatred, non-bewilderment, joyful perseverance, suppleness, conscientiousness, equanimity, non-violence.
Okay, these are not merely negations of the confusion. They are intended to be actively cultivated in the work we do. Now let's take a look at the very first one. someone, maybe someone who has the document, want to say something about why we start with something called faith. What does that mean? We've been told not to be true believers. What does this mean? This is just, this is the entry point. It's very critical.
I had trouble with that word because I think of faith as hope. Hope, and then that's exactly what, you know, Kevin Children says, abandon hope, because hope is the opposite of fear. So they mean faith is something else.
What?
But maybe in our culture, faith often means, oh, you just have to have faith. It's kind of like a blind hopefulness or something.
But we don't mean that, really.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that.
What,
right?
What do we mean? This is critical.
It's a confidence.
Confidence, yes.
Confidence is an interesting word, right? It's an attitude.
It's an attitude. It's an attitude that our mind can really do this. That instead of sloughing off and running to the negative, yeah, we actually can cultivate.
I can do this. Which is, to me, very different from faith.
Okay.
Maybe it's faith in yourself.
Yeah.
It's not something external.
So you have to have faith in your own potential.
Your potential.
Right. Oh.
We're talking about Buddha nature here.
Right.
We're talking about Buddhahood. Yeah. And somehow, with a spark of that insight that we actually have this potential in ourselves for enlightenment, enlightened mind is actually in us, we can have faith in that as the motivation.
Everyone comes here, even if they get upset or angry or confused, everyone here, all of us, are here because we see that something is possible. That it's possible within us, and we want to wake up to that. And therefore, of these 11, this is the starting point. Before we, yes?
I think also that as you practice, you'll begin to organically do better with it. You know, some of the stuff will just kind of sink in and be available to you. And then when that happens, when you realize, wow, I just was able to handle that situation differently, you begin to get more and more confident that this works. This is working in me.
This is working in me. That's a very good point. And before we've ever hit Dharma, we can be very confused. We don't see any difference between believing in this or having faith in this or listening even to a teacher who... a real enlightened teacher, if we have him present, and following our mind out to all sorts of bad situations and false gurus and so on. They seem, you know, to our confused mind to be very similar. But as we start to work on the wholesome factors, they start to separate. And as we go through them and cultivate them, we start to see clearly the difference between waking up and following confusion. We're starting to separate them. And each one of these is a step in separating them. This first one is so important for that reason.
Seems to me, I see in faith, trust in the unknown unfolding. That is, I accept what is going to unfold, although I don't know what it is, and I feel I can't anticipate it. I just trust that it's good, that the unfolding will be acceptable.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, that's
good.
Yeah.
Okay, now we have self-respect and respect for others. So, what do they mean? Self-respect.
It seems like it's about your behavior and your attitude towards yourself and other people. That, you know, the kind of thing that people say, like, you wouldn't do that if you thought highly of yourself, you wouldn't act in a certain way. And sort of having that attitude that I'm going to be that way, and I'm going to be that way to others. I'm actually thinking of my son when he did his, in the Unitarian Church, we don't do bar mitzvahs or confirmation, we do coming of age. Mm-hmm. And each kid writes their own statement about what their beliefs are. My son, when he was 13 or 14, he said what he learned, all religion belief is, you shouldn't be a jerk, and you shouldn't allow others to be jerks.
That's fine. And a little bit more than this is, if I have confidence in my awakeness, my confidence is that I will not do this. That I will not disrespect myself. My confidence is I will not disrespect others because, not because of me, but because of awakeness which is growing in me.
It's almost like you're having self-respect for that inner light, for that inner being that you know is there. Mm-hmm. That's where your self-respect goes. Mm-hmm.
And you recognize that everyone else has that same potential.
Everyone
has the same potential.
Everyone has this potential that can be cultivated, yes. That's important.
And then you can also see how your conduct ties into this, which is the last sentence here. Self-respect prevents our conduct from becoming, our conduct from becoming chaotic and unrestrained. So there's a sense of you're seeing how to behave and you're actually taking it to heart. So this is the changes that we're looking for here. Yeah.
Respect for others is a sense of embarrassment or shame to do something unwholesome when considering others. Enlightenment does not go along with hurting others or putting others down.
So what's the reference point for unwholesome, the word unwholesome? It seems like it's external or internal or both.
What does it say?
Well, in the past couple of sections, we've already used the word
unwholesome.
So it's like an external reference point.
It is?
No.
You just said it's...
He's asking if
it's... Yeah. It's not really defined. I agree.
It's not defined. What do you mean unwholesome?
So it would be something that causes the kleshas to arise more and more as opposed to cooling off the klesha activity, emotional reaction. So it's... Unwholesome stirs up emotional reactivity. Maybe I made that up.
We have to, to see if it shows up somewhere as an answer.
Could it be unwholesome to the body? I mean,
That's true.
You can think of it in terms of what does it lead to? What kind of result is it going to produce?
Right.
Wholesome activities produce wholesome results. Unwholesome activities produce the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
I was agreeing.
So we have self-respect, respect for others. Then we have these three things which are actually active things. They're not just negations. Non-attachment, non-hatred, non-bewilderment. What is non-attachment? Described as absence of desire or detachment concerning existence or its attributes. It increases the remedy for attachment and withdraws us from a compulsive involvement with the object through an understanding of its true nature, and thereby eliminates the grasping and clinging to possess which could otherwise induce harmful acts.
I like the word compulsive there. I think that's a very powerful description of this.
Compulsive is... It's not that our mind isn't going to want something,
right.
But that whether we don't cling to the wanting.
Mm-hmm. It sounded like the sentence you read started with the absence of desire. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
Which is really, you know, that sounds
Steve.
Possible.
Well, we're going to talk about that next week. Don't worry.
I understand not grasping and not, you know, clinging firmly, but the absence of desire.
Think about it like this. These are attitudes. Non-attachment doesn't mean you won't have desires. It doesn't mean you won't have particularly emotional feelings of fondness and of tremendous activism or feeling wonderful about someone or a situation or an experience. But it's a willingness to let go of letting that own you.
Yeah.
So then it has to do with something about non-grasping. It has something to do with that freedom. Mm-hmm. That we're willing to opt for freedom from being
pulled,
trapped by what we want and what we like and what we don't like.
Right.
We don't identify.
That's where it happens. Saying that means we have to actually understand what that actually employs. What does it mean not to be identified with something? We actually have to go through the process of disengagement from that identification thing. Oh, this is me. This is my family. This is my life. I can't, get away from that. And so the meditation practice is giving us the capacity to taste freedom, the space between the thoughts. It gives us room to expand into openness and discover that attachment has all this to do with grasping. It's some form of grasping, ultimately. Mm-hmm. So we're learning about that, non-grasping.
Is non-attachment...
Wait. Question. Yeah.
So how do we become not attached? It's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
It is hard, yes. And it takes meditation and sitting with yourself and seeing that not that desires are going to go away, but that whether they go away or not go away, you don't have to be sucked into holding on to it with your mind. Your mind starts to be more freedom in your mind. It actually gives you more energy not to be attached.
So meditation is the practice. That's where we're practicing to create that gap. And then off the cushion, hopefully we're finding that gap a little more.
Off the cushion.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. I mean, you've just come here the first time. That's fine. Second time, which is?
Me? I kind of come in here like...
Yeah, right. Okay.
This is the first.
First
time.
So these things actually require pretty much that you put the work into it, preferably daily.
Mm-hmm.
It's like if you want to learn how to play piano, it wouldn't do to once a week go to a teacher and ask for the theory of it and then think about it. If the teacher says every day you're going to do scales and chords, you got to do it. Or you can just sit and listen and put this in the reserve and someday maybe you'll do it. But we hope all of us to make progress because time is short and we could die at any time.
Oh, that gets to the heart.
Reach the light your way.
That's the way to get to
the other thing to perhaps...
That actually reminds me of a story I heard from another meditation teacher, which is that they were asking, it was an introductory class and people were being asked why they were here, and there was a 17-year-old woman and a 90-year-old woman, and they both said, "I'm here because time is short." So basically it's short from all perspectives.
Yeah. It doesn't matter how old you are.
Megan?
Yeah, I just want to say that from my perspective, that the act of physically sitting, which means you just sit, you're not getting up and making a cup of coffee or scrambled eggs or calling somebody, or you're just physically sitting. And just by physically embracing that fact, it actually helps train the mind to also just sit, just be still with all the the crazy mind, you know, the flashes of the mind, which is all the time. And so that, again, to the off the cushion, so that even as you're walking through daily life, there's an opportunity, should you choose, to actually, instead of physically and maybe even emotionally or mentally grasping, holding on to whatever it is, you, because you've been sitting for some time and learning how to just be with it.
You look a monk.
Yeah. That you actually can have that opportunity off the cushion, as Megan was saying. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thanks, Megan.
You know, when I think of my attachment, emptiness comes up. Is that? Do you think that has to be my
attachment? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
That's,
emptiness, but how do we get to emptiness? What's the practical thing to do?
Well, meditate.
Well, meditate and use your mind to see that you can let go.
Yeah.
That's why these are active. Okay, these are things we can do. But without the practice, it won't occur to us to even think of these things if we don't spend some time keeping still. But then we still have to do them. So it was non-attachment and non-hatred, which is not too different in what we've said. The absence of ill will towards living beings and their conditions. Sometimes there's a language problem. The absence of ill will towards living beings and their suffering and the conditions of their suffering. Is that a way to read that?
Yeah. Makes more sense.
Yeah. It has the characteristic of loving kindness, which directly overcomes hatred. It prevents hatred and strengthens love, patient acceptance, discipline, etc. Instead of blindly reacting with agitation to something, which tension and anger, when confronted with, for example, someone inflicting harm on us, or the harm itself, or the instrument of the harm, whatever it is, something's out there, we can see that our mind doesn't have to go out and grab onto the threat. It doesn't mean we won't take effective action when we need to take effective action, but our mind will be rested and effective rather than dwelling uselessly. When cultivated, it helps to stop harmful acts and eradicates anger and hatred. So we can, again, something actively to be cultivated. Then the third one is a little harder to see.
You think
the sixth one?
It's number six, but I should just mention that these three, non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-bewilderment, they're active, and they're acting counter to passion, aggression, and ignorance. Mm-hmm. So those are the three that we have at the center of the wheel of life of samsara. It's sort of the center of the wheel and makes the whole thing keep going. So there they are again, our favorite three, passion, aggression, and ignorance.
You know, those are the basic, what we call three poisons of Buddhism. They're fundamentally the things that are snagging us from beginningless time, getting us caught up, turning again and again over in circles, and just repeating, creating misery. They're the recipe for fundamental misery.
So non-bewilderment is a clarity and sharpness of mind that, like a lamp in a dark room, dispels bewilderment about a particular object. In particular, it is knowing and understanding the results of actions, the Dharma and liberation. It arises either from an inborn disposition or from the three trainings, which we don't quite have time to get into now. It is the remedy for ignorance and accompanies the firm intelligence that thoroughly analyzes the true nature of objects, what is real.
Well, the three trainings we have talked about quite a lot.
Yeah.
Those are the two prajnas. So hearing or hearing, contemplating, and meditating is how we presented it. This is the same.
There's again a reference here to a book called The Jewel Ornament of Liberation by Gampopa. It's a book which is Tibetan and brilliant and wonderful, but it would take a lot of effort to read it. And you may recall that Gampopa is the author of the four dharmas that we say at the beginning of every class. He was a great teacher, but that's a big, thick book.
Well, to just give you an encapsulation, it's the encyclopedia of the Mahayana path. So it's everything from soup to nuts.
Encyclopedia.
If you want to really have a very systematic presentation of what we've been talking about previously, including skandhas, what we call, and certainly it talks about the paramitas, it talks about the stages of enlightenment, the bodhisattva path. It's very, very well spelled out. And anyone who should want to have it as a reference, it would be well worth your investment.
The last sentence is really interesting, I think. It is not wisdom itself, but the lucid quality that accompanies wisdom.
Like that. Where are you reading?
It's the last sentence of the non-dual paragraph.
Right here.
Oh. It is not wisdom but itself, but the lucid quality that accompanies wisdom. Yeah.
It's just really intriguing.
Well, so we really, there is a real progression. So there's clear seeing, vipassana, we've used that, awareness. So we have mindfulness and awareness. And prajna, so there's more mundane prajna when you know how to fix your car or something. And then there's higher prajna. So that's where you're starting to get a lot of insight and penetration through your intellect. But then the intellect isn't enough. Wisdom then is beyond all that. But there is a progression there.
Is that akin to the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana?
Not quite.
It doesn't line up quite like that.
We can't make a systematic theory
like that.
Here. We have to waken up to what's said.
But we're working here with consciousness, and there's a whole teaching on consciousness dawns as wisdom. So we say that in the four dharmas again.
And that's applied in all those dhammas just mentioned.
Yes.
All these things that you just mentioned, the whole wisdom, nature of wisdom and what it is something as we progress to explore and learn more about, we find sort of gets more and more refined, as it were, and more pithy or completely essential. We're getting at the real essential.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
These three are the foundation of everything virtuous that puts an end to all unwholesome actions. They are not only the absence of the three main kleshas of attachment, hatred, and ignorance, but their active, wholesome, remedial counterparts. The take-home message tonight is that we can actually cultivate the wholesome aspects of our mind. And it's very beneficial to us to do so. More on that?
That's good.
Okay. So, that was fine. Joyful perseverance.
Perseverance.
joyful perseverance, energy, or enthusiasm is a firm mental effort, an awake, diligent state of mind based on self-confidence that joyously engages in the preparation and practice of any wholesome activity. It is characterized by absence of weakness, not turning back on a task, and never being self-satisfied. This is a reference to a paramita. I think it's the fourth paramita here, energy. And if you want to look at the paramitas, we have a module on that. It's module 15. This is module 17 right now. And we went through that. And they are referenced here. So this is a remedy for, it's actually an energizing of the mind, a forward-looking energy that we can feel that there's more to come as our mind engages in wholesome factors. Now we come to one called suppleness. This is a very important one, which our teacher talked a lot about. And I've put in parenthesis the word Shinjan. I spelled it differently than here, so you can see how it's pronounced, Shinjan. Suppleness, pliancy, flexibility, Shinjan, enables mind and body through relaxation to be applied to a wholesome object in whatever manner is wished, for example, to solve an intellectual problem or to accomplish a contemplation or meditation. It overcomes mental and thus physical rigidity or heaviness. It purifies our mind and makes the mind flexible and quick. Suppleness is the workability of our mind, the capacity to let go of one thing in order to take up and stay with something more beneficial. In this way, suppleness is the basis of mental calm and insight meditation. Rigidity is a state of mind where one is unable to do what one wishes, and that gives rise to all kinds of afflictions. So now we're being told that there's actually a right way to engage intellectually, which is not the conceptual mind we always put down. There actually is a right way to use our mind to see what is to be seen and to work with it.
It seems like suppleness is a good partner to patience.
Yeah? How so?
How so?
Yeah. Tell me.
Because sometimes when you are patient, you would have to use this skill. So, you know, you just have to adjust. I don't know, it just seems like an automatic thing to me in a way. Suppleness of mind, patience, kind of.
No, that's good.
Go together.
Yeah.
I don't know. The concept kind of enhances my experience or how I would interpret patience.
Trungpa says, Shinjan means thoroughly processed or supple. Shinjan means experiencing virtue, the absence of ego, and the feeling of freedom that goes along with that. Mm-hmm. One actually feels free and liberated.
Yeah, I kind of see suppleness as being part of a non-attachment.
Seems like all those things.
They feed each other.
Yeah, they're all building up. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This virtue frees you from a depressed state of mind, from the depression of the lower realms. We'll hear about those next week. With Shinjan, you know how to ride your mind. And having tamed your mind, you learn how to make friends with it. Having made friends with it, you learn how to make use of it. This is what is meant by riding the mind. Trungpa Rinpoche often pointed out that when you do the hard work of looking at mind over time, becoming more of a Shinjan person, he would say, you feel more relaxed with a real sense of equilibrium, even in difficult situations. Even other people may even notice a change in your being or presence if one works in developing this. Trungpa always said working on developing Xinjiang is very ordinary, just staying with what's real and not going off into what's fantasy or not real. It's so absolutely ordinary. And yet, he also said, it's the most powerful magic in the world, too. And he used the word magic. Just to be ordinary is the most powerful magic in the world, much more so than the magic of magicians, much more so than the magic of those who learn how to conquer the world or use magic for power. Just being simple and ordinary is the most powerful magic, he would say.
Again, the word came up, gentleness.
There's a gentleness to
being
it.
Being gentleness, not attacking something. You know, just being able to just hold it.
Okay, there's three more.
We could just add, you know, in some sense, when we're kind to our mind, when we're kind to ourselves, we give it a chance to actually do what it can do. We're not getting in the way of what its own possibilities are. So gentleness is a very good word, I think, and appropriate in terms of being able to understand how we work, and Linda used the word patience earlier, the whole, how we can incorporate various ways of understanding how to develop supple mind. And it is a development, something we work on. We actually develop. These are all things that we can actually cultivate. They are here. We have it in us. These are our own potential.
Conscientiousness or diligence cherishes the accumulation of what is wholesome. It develops favorable conditions and guards the mind against that which gives rise to afflictions. Accompanied by enthusiasm, one is very careful and conscientious about not committing unwholesome actions. In other words, we're cultivating all sorts of things, and here we don't want to lose them. So we're particularly working on making sure that we stay with the program, if you like. Conscientiousness protects from reacting in a negative way.
See, and that relates to discipline. I mean, it seems like all of these are really just relate to the six paramitas.
They do.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
They're all.
They do relate to the paramitas a lot. That's, you're correct in that, yes. And they're sort of building up here. Because we get to equanimity, which of course means you don't get thrown off your horse. Keeps the mind balanced and calm without letting it become either carelessly distracted or unclear and dull. If the quality and stability of a mind...
It is
the quality and stability of a mind not interested in clinging. It is passive in the sense of not reacting emotionally to stimuli. It prevents excitement and dullness without having to exert a great effort. In other words, it's becoming less a matter of effort now to maintain wholesome factors. And the last one, nonviolence, is actually the lacking any intention to harm. This is the way a bodhisattva behaves, finally. It is compassion, the strong urge not to disrespect others by killing and hurting them or by putting them down, as well as the aspiration that all beings may be separated from suffering. This is the activity of a bodhisattva beyond any sense of self. And again, these 11 wholesome factors should not be taken for granted, as often they are actually quite weak in our stream of being. They are a potential. They need to be cultivated.
The term mind stream, that's an interesting term.
What?
Just just the term mind stream.
Yes.
I haven't heard that term before. I like that. Is that
the one in the mind?
This list is to draw your attention to what's in your mind. If we ran to about 10 after, would that bother people terribly?
I might pull out my chair.
I gotta go.
Okay, if you have to
you
go,
can keep going, but I gotta leave.
Okay. I know that. So, we have come now to the negative stuff, right? And they happen to be 6 root factors of emotional obscuration. And then they get followed by the 20 secondary afflictions, which mean that once you start getting into emotional obscuration, what happens? Worse things happen. But there's 6 of them, and each one has a long discussion, so we'll see what happens. Reader for section D.
Lisa. The root afflictions bind us to the cycle of disconnected existence, thereby acting as the primary cause for all of our suffering and frustration. Put the mind into a state of turmoil and unrest that results in mental or physical activity which is harmful to both oneself and others. They are the real challenge in the practice of Dharma. Doubt and erroneous views are mentioned separately.
What are you reading?
D?
She's reading the dictionary of the whole section. She just wanted to read the list.
I just want to read the list.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. No harm done.
Oh, sorry about that.
What is the list? 6.
The 6. Desire, anger, pride, ignorance, doubt, and erroneous views.
Okay. We will have this posted. Okay. So actually, there's a fair amount of discussion about each one. Desire is clinging to the 3 realms of existence, leads to suffering. Attachment to the world of desire is everything we could desire. And attachment to existence, that is believing form and formless wheels. We're going to get to that next week, I'm sure. But based on sensations, first arises an inclination towards an object, an initial impulse to go towards it, whereas an aversion of the impulse is to go backwards away from it. Fascination arises more, and more longing arises. As you experience the object more, you do not want to separate from it anymore. So there's a grasping quality going on here. If our emotions due to attachment are very strong, we develop strong dependencies. Which is there's a theme of grasping being addictive, is being suggested here. We can neither live without our dependencies, nor can we live without our aversions, since both have become our main reference points. Most people think they do not need their aversions, that they're just a nuisance. But if you actually try to take away the object of their anger from someone who's addicted to it, it is close to impossible. To practice means to cut through early in the process before a chain reaction starts. So if this arises, we do not have to wait until we have big emotions. If we can see it right away, cut, fine. If we can see it 10 seconds later, that's better than hanging out with it for a week. Yeah.
What if throughout the years we grow to have like negative thinking, then how can we cut from that if the passage said that it's nearly impossible to like, cut someone from their habits?
Someone else or yourself?
Myself.
by working on it.
So I think part of it is as you become aware of what's happening in your mind, like you said, if you can start to notice, like actually see, I'm really wanting this thing, and I'm wanting it for like not any good reason. I'm not wanting it because I need it or because it would do something good. But you catch it sooner, as opposed to sort of when things are just stirring around in your mind and in the back of your brain, then suddenly you're like, oh my God, I just have to have this. And you don't even know where did that thought come from, that I have to have this, I see it in the store. But when you become aware, you start to say, oh, I'm looking at that like it's really special. And you can start to look at that thought and say, well, it's not that special. Because the emotion, when the emotion gets strong, it's hard to cut that. When you really like, I have to have that. Those are the nicest boots. They'll keep me warm. They'll keep me dry. My life will be terrible if I don't have them. But if you look and you say, I already have pretty good boots. I don't really need to do that right away. You can cut sooner before you got like, oh.
Let me tell you something that happens to everyone as soon as we're given meditation instruction. All of us. So you're given meditation instruction, and let's say you actually do it, and you're told to sit and be mindful of your breath, right? And notice the thoughts arising. And then that person comes back to the meditation instructor 2 weeks later and saying, I'm not doing it right. This is making it worse. I'm having lots of thoughts now. And the meditation instructor says, no, you're doing just fine. Now you know that you have lots of thoughts. 2 weeks ago you didn't. That happens to all of us.
And the other thing, but your question specifically was around negative thoughts or negative thinking patterns. And so everyone here who has been practicing for a while could discuss the benefits of meditation practice, which is basically what happens is by just gently, continuously working with your thoughts and the breath and opening ourselves up to space, that we actually begin to loosen that kind of grip that negative thoughts have on us. And it's like punching holes, or when you sort of see these little links, like chain links of offense, you know, just linking, they start to break down because we're allowing space to come in between. We're there. We're not just spacing out. We're actually being present.
Bernie wants to say something.
And so that's where the actual power of meditation helps us learn how to loosen and weaken that power of negative thinking, because it's a deeply entrenched habit we all have. And we all have different kinds of negative thoughts. Not the same, but the point is that the meditation practice, this is all of this is based and contingent on utilizing meditation as the basis for our work on ourselves. So we're not only trying to get calm and peaceful, we're actually need to actually learn to take responsibility for our own experience, and by actually learning about the nature of our mind and how it works. And then we don't have to be taken over by those experiences.
Thank you. I was going to say pretty much the same thing. I guess that I think if you meditate and you look at the negative thinking, it loses its power to some extent. And you bring it, oh, negative thinking, it's like, big deal. So it does dissipate.
Okay, so you got hit with something. Keep coming back. Okay.
So I think we should try to summarize the last thing.
Okay.
To not take too much longer.
Okay, so we have these negative things, which include passion, aggression, ignorance, like one, doubt, and erroneous views, which amounts to sort of believing too much in ourself. We are running out of time, but there are six of them, and they're very thoroughly developed in the text, if you read the text. And there's a lot of good stuff there. And it seems like we don't have time we are running out of time for the secondary afflictions, but we should read the list. So if we have a reader, you'll see that what's going on here is that if we allow these root ones, where does our mind go from there? Can we have a list of reader for the 20, section E?
Yeah, all
right.
Rage, rancor, concealment, animosity, jealousy, avarice, duplicity, deceit, self-satisfaction, maliciousness, lack of self-respect, lack of respect for others, dullness, wildness, lack of confidence, laziness, carelessness, confused memory, lack of discernment, distraction.
Wow. So once we let go, we can go further and further and further in those directions until we get totally insane behavior against ourselves, against the world. It is almost at the end. There's one little final section which I'm not even going to go, you can read it on your own. It has four variable factors. One of them, incidentally, is sleep. And these are factors that can go either way again. And sleep is beneficial if we use it to get the necessary rest we need. And it's particularly beneficial if we can use sleep as we go to sleep to make our resolution that we will cultivate our pure mind, our beneficial, virtuous, to cultivate them. That is a particularly good way to use sleep. To go to sleep to avoid our life would be a particularly bad way. But you can read about those four if you want.
Just for the tape, let me just read these four. So the four variable factors are regret, sleep, reasoning, and investigation.
Quick question. What do those variable factors mean?
It means, like the first 10, it means that they could be used to cultivate our pure intentions, or they could be used to cultivate samsara.
They can go either way.
Either
negative
way.
Negative or positive.
Yeah, they can go negative or positive, and the more we purify the mind, the more we will use those and anything else that comes up to cultivate our pure intentions. So I hope that that is the take-home message. The 11, what are they called?
Samskaras.
11 wholesome factors.
Wholesome.
We can cultivate the 11 wholesome factors so they become stronger in our mind stream.